Brothers and sisters, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala ashrafil anbiya'i wal mursaleen, habibi ilahi al-alamin, abil qasim al-mustafa Muhammad. على بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. قال الله تعالى في محكم كتابه الكريم: أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الذين ينفقون في السراء والضراء والكاظمين الغيظ والعافين عن الناس والله يحب المحسنين. آمنا بالله، صدق الله العلي العظيم. Most of us, especially those who may have been born or raised or spent most of their lives in the United States here, most perhaps have not experienced firsthand circumstances of oppression or injustice or persecution or direct results of war or famine or other major catastrophes or troublesome times. Most, and I say this from personal experience, although I was born in Mashhad in the 80s during the war between Iran and Iraq, but I never actually experienced it firsthand. We left when I was very young, and I did not experience war or any troublesome time. I grew up in a society where, for the most part, safety, stability, security was something that came with the society and the environment that I lived in. And many of us, I think, most of us, perhaps, for the most part of our lives, or for a great time of our lives, at least here in the United States, we have not experienced firsthand oppression or persecution or injustice. In fact, many came from other societies in order to flee such troublesome environments and circumstances. If we look around the world today, we'll notice that in many different parts of the world, many people are facing all sorts of injustices, all sorts of persecution, all sorts of oppression and injustice. Many different parts of the world, if we travel, many people are experiencing, many people who are dying from hunger, from lack of basic nutrition and access to health care and sanitation. Many people who are facing diseases and death because of this. Many people who live in very oppressive regimes, in very oppressive states, where they're not able to speak, where they're not able to practice their religion or their faith freely, where they're not able to do the things that they want to do freely. There's a lot of oppression, there's a lot of persecution around the world. And because of this, because we live in a society that is generally stable and secure, especially in certain parts of the United States, if we look at here, Southern California, and especially Orange County, and especially this area, we'll notice that it's considered perhaps one of the most safest and secure areas. Safety is prevalent. Many people live in a very safe neighborhoods, very safe environments. They don't necessarily fear crime or persecution in general. And so this, in many cases, has led some individuals to take what? To take some of these blessings, safety and security and stability, for granted. We take it for granted. When we wake up in the morning, we wake up expecting to go, you know, to get dressed, to go to work, to go to school, to take care of our daily life routine, to come back safely. Our families, our spouses, our children, they go to school, they come back, they go to work. And we have a sense of safety and security. We don't always necessarily have security on the top of our minds in our day-to-day routines. And so many people take safety and security for granted. And this is why many times we notice that in the society that we live in, some people, young and old, we've noticed that they've began to complain about superficial problems. There's talk of, you know, problems that are considered first world problems. And sometimes they're humorous. When we read about these problems, they're humorous. People complaining about, you know, lack of reception on their cell phones, or, you know, slow internet access, or, you know, the food wasn't that great, or this wasn't, you know, it was a little too hot, it was a little too cold. Issues which are known as first world problems, because we're not really facing major issues. There's no issues of persecution, oppression, there's no issues of injustice or security that we face. So we tend to do what? We tend to take them for granted, and we find other things to complain about. Whereas when we look at ourselves and we consider ourselves as Muslims, and especially as Shias, the followers of Ahlul Bayt, if we look in our history, we'll notice that the history of Islam, and especially the history of Shia Islam, the followers of Ahlul Bayt, has been filled with injustice, where Muslims, and especially Shia Muslims, have been victims of oppression, injustice, pain, suffering throughout the history of Islam. If we examine the history of Islam, we notice that this was the case immediately after the departure of the Holy Prophet. Through the early period of Islam, through the period of the Umayyad dynasty, when they rose, these rulers came to power and they did what they did. And then after they fell, and instead of them came Rum, the Abbasis, who continued, although they were relatives, the Abbasis, they were relatives of the Ahlul Bayt, of Bani Hashim, but they continued their persecution towards the followers of Ahlul Bayt and towards the descendants of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And this persecution and this injustice and oppression, it continued throughout the history of Islam and even until today. In certain parts of the world, if you're Shia, it's dangerous for you to be Shia. It's dangerous for you to announce that you are Shia or the follower of Ahlul Bayt. In countries now, recently, in countries, for instance, such as Malaysia and Indonesia, in these countries, it has become illegal for a person to be Shia. Illegal. In countries where only a few years, a few decades ago, you know, the banner of religious freedom and tolerance and open-mindedness and anti-extremism was raised, and, you know, an inclusive society, a welcoming society. Today, it is illegal for those who consider themselves to be the followers of Ahlul Bayt and the Shia of Ahlul Bayt, it is illegal for them to do so, to practice. Many of them are incarcerated, many of them are persecuted. I remember this last past Muharram, I was in Singapore for lectures for Ashura. Many individuals had come from neighboring Malaysia and Indonesia. They had come for Ashura to Singapore, and they told me, I heard this from them personally, they told me that we are not able to attend majalis in our countries. We are not able to. The authorities, they come and they raid our homes and they raid our centers and they incarcerate us. And this is why we have to travel outside of our countries and come towards this place, to Singapore, so that what? So that we can just participate in the majlis of the remembrance of Imams. Until this day. But when we look at history, we notice that especially this injustice and this oppression was especially directed towards the Ahlul Bayt and the Imams of Ahlul Bayt. Each and every one of them. Each and every one of them. If you go now and you take a book on the history of Islam, just an average book written by an academic, a scholar, who considers him or herself an expert on Islamic history, if you were to go and you were just to read this book, many of them, unfortunately, the vast majority will not even talk about these issues. Even though they might discuss the issues of the development of Shi'ism, for instance, and who the main figures within Shia thought are and the imams, they talk about them, but they do not talk about the oppression and the injustice that was faced by the imams of Ahlul Bayt and the followers of Ahlul Bayt by the ruling classes, by the ruling masses. They don't talk about it. Or they tend to neglect it or dismiss it. Or they say that, you know, they did face persecution, but it was based on personal grudges. Some people, they had personal grudges with Imam Ali, for instance. Ibn Muljam had personal grudge with Imam Ali, and so he decided to come and assassinate him. And the same with the other imams. They tried to dismiss the oppression and injustice that was directed towards the imams, unfortunately. But if we go back to our authentic sources, we notice that each and every imam was a victim of the cruelty and the oppression of the ruling classes. Yet, when we examine their lives, we notice that with all of this persecution, they were still able to do what? They were still able to overcome these challenges and excel in obtaining all these noble virtues and exhibiting positive leadership towards the community. Even with all of the persecution and all of the injustice that was faced, the imams were still able to exhibit positive leadership and to teach the masses in a positive way. They were able to overcome these challenges. One example which we will be discussing tonight is the example of our seventh imam, an Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, who during his time he faced many harsh consequences of the ruling class. An Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was born, according to historians, he was born in the year 128 after Hijrah. And he lived until the year 183 after Hijrah. So he lived for about 55 years. History tells us that an Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, Musa the son of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, that he became the Imam at the age of 20 after the martyrdom of his father, al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. And so he became an Imam at 20 and he attained martyrdom at 55, so the period of his imamah was 35 years. Historians tell us that this was the longest period of imamah. From between all of the imams, the longest period of imamah was that of al-Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. But when we examine his life, we notice that the imam lived in one of the most critical and crucial times in the history of Islam for the imams of Ahlul Bayt and for the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Why? Because when the imam, history tells us that when the imam was about 4 or 5 years old, the imam was born in 128 after Hijrah, which corresponds to about 745 in the common era, CE. In 750, what happened? In 750, the Umayyad dynasty fell, and in place of the Umayyad dynasty came who? The Abbasids. The Umayyads, they ruled for about 100 years. But we know that the Umayyads were very oppressive. They were very unjust. They were very corrupt. And as a result, because of their corruption, and because of what happened in the case of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and the succeeding revolts that occurred, because of this, they were able to topple the Umayyad regime. But the Umayyad regime, as it was toppled, it was replaced by whom? It was replaced by the Abbasis. The Abbasis, history tells us, they are the descendants of who? They are the descendants of Al-Abbas, who was the uncle of the Prophet. So thus, the Abbasis, in essence, they're the cousins of the Prophet. They're the cousins of Bani Hashim. And through popular support, the Abbasis, they were able to overthrow the Umayyads and they were able to come to power themselves. However, the Abbasis, when we read about history, when we read in many cases, we read about their history, historians, some historians will say that the Abbasis, that they were very good with Banu Hashim, that they loved the Banu Hashim, they displayed affection towards Banu Hashim. But however, when we read accurate history, we notice that this was not the case. No. In fact, from day one, when the Abbasis came into power, they launched many campaigns against the Imams of Ahlul Bayt and against the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, and specifically against the descendants of whom? Of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And there are many books that are written regarding what the Abbasis did towards the Imams and the followers of Ahlul Bayt, and especially towards the descendants and the progeny of Imam Ali alayhi salam. The first of these rulers, Abbasi rulers, was who? What was his name? Abu al-Abbas al-Saffah. Abu al-Abbas, his name was Abdullah. His kunya was Abu al-Abbas. And his nickname was As-Saffah, which he himself attributed to himself. Not that others, they saw him and they called him As-Saffah. He himself proudly announced that he was As-Saffah, which means what? The blood shedder. As-Saffah means the one who sheds blood. Why? Because as soon as Abu al-Abbas As-Saffah came into power, they toppled the Umayyads. He went on a killing spree, killing all of the Umayyads who were left of the ruling Umayyads, except one who was able, Marwan, who was able to flee and go towards the west, towards Andalusia and Spain, and establish his reign there. And in addition, towards the descendants of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And thus, this period, the beginning of the Abbasis, was marked by immense corruption, by immense persecution and oppression and injustice and brutality towards others. And it continued. It continued with each and every ruler of the Abbasis. The corruption and the tyrannical and dictatorial nature of these individuals grew. Historians tell us that immediately they established what? They established an order whereby, like the Umayyads, it was hereditary. It was a dynasty where a ruler would come after his father. It would be passed down through their progeny, one after another. And historians, they tell us that not only were they brutal, but they were excessive and they were extravagant in terms of squandering wealth. They were very corrupt. Very corrupt. Because their purpose was not to implement justice or the rule of law or to teach people how to become better people or morality. No. Because the reason for their rise was what? Was because of power. Because they wanted to obtain power. And so they did everything in their capacity in order to keep and safeguard and maintain that power. Even if it meant going on killing sprees. Even if it meant destroying people. Even if it meant squandering people's wealth and their money. Historians, they tell us that many of them, for instance, in the case of Harun, who they call al-Rashid, Harun, in his case, they suggest that he was very well known for what? For his excessiveness and his extravagance. That he would use the wealth of Baytul Mal for his personal use. That at the time of Harun's death, he left over 100 million gold dinars in terms of money. And that his jewelry and his possessions, they outweighed that amount in terms of his possessions. And that when he died, he left behind him how many slave girls? 2,000 slave girls he had possessed, he left behind him. Not only him, but even his wife Zubaydah, she was also known. Historians, they tell us that Zubaydah, she also considered Baytul Mal to be her private property. Right? Now him, they can try to attempt to justify and say he's the Khalifa. But why his wife? His wife also, historians tell us that she spent money very lavishly and extravagantly to the point where she had her sandals made, studded with pearls. The sandals that she would wear. And the rugs that she would have made out of pure silk and embroidered in gold and pearls. These are some examples that are given from some of the Abbasi rulers, like in the case of Harun. But this amount of extravagance and corruption that the Abbasis had, the people, they saw this, they noticed this, and as a result, this led to a series of revolts, just like the Umayyads. The Umayyads, the people saw, and they revolted many times, many different times. The people, they revolted against the Umayyads. Similarly, during the time of the Abbasis, there were a number of revolts against the Abbasis. One of these revolts that historians, they tell us, was at the time of the fourth Abbasi ruler, who was known as Musa al-Hadi, the fourth Abbasi ruler. During his time, in the year 169, one of the descendants of al-Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, whose name was al-Husayn ibn Ali, just like Imam Husayn, his name was also al-Husayn ibn Ali, who was one of the great grandsons of al-Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, he and a group of his supporters and family members, they decided that they were going to revolt against whom? Against the Abbasi caliph by the name of Musa al-Hadi. This was in the year 169 after Hijra. And this, what ended up happening was on the day of the 9th of Dhul Hijjah, the day of what? The day before the Hajj begins, on the 8th of Dhul Hijjah, before the day of Hajj. This man, Al-Husayn ibn Ali and his companions, over 100 individuals, they fought against whom? Against the Abbasi army, and they were all brutally massacred. They were all killed, known as the Battle of what? Fakh. This is one of those battles and killings that many people in history are not aware of. Al-Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, he says that this revolt, this murder, after Karbala, this was the most disastrous murder in the history of the Ahlul Bayt. And it was the most painful. This is what the Imam says, Al-Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam. He says that this revolt, this rise, and the massacre of these individuals was the most painful and the most tragic after the massacre of Karbala, the massacre of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. This was one example. There were many that occurred. And this was a very difficult period. But when we come to the life of the Imam, when we come to the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we notice that he was able to endure this period with extra strength and perseverance. History tells us that many of the companions, just like I mentioned earlier, many of the descendants of Imam Ali, many of the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, they were persecuted and they were tortured. Some of the things that were done to them are unspeakable. How brutal and oppressive this persecution was. Historians tell us that some of them, they would be taken and they would be placed in buildings that were not complete, pillars that were not complete, they would be placed and the building would be completed on top of them and they would be left to suffer and to suffocate. This was one of the methods that was used. There were mass killings, mass murders of the descendants of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Historians tell us that Harun, he would send some of his cronies to go and kill dozens of the descendants of Imam Ali at once. One of his people by the name of Ibn Qurtuba. He says that once Harun, he asked me, he told me, how is your loyalty to me? The man told him, I'm very loyal to you. You are the caliph, you are the ruler, I'm very loyal to you. And so he told him, okay, I want to test your loyalty. I want you to go to so-and-so home, and in this home, you will find someone who will give you instructions. The man, he says, I went to this home, and I found a person waiting at the door, a guard waiting at the door. He handed me a sword, he told me, I want you to go into this home, and whoever you see alive, you slaughter them immediately. So the man says, I entered into this home, and I found three rooms. I opened the first room, I found 20 men who were the descendants of Imam Ali who were incarcerated. And I entered the room and I killed all of them. He says, I came out, I went into the second room, there were also another 20 of the descendants of Imam Ali, I entered and I killed all of them. I exited, I went into the third room, I found another 20 of them and I murdered them. And this was how the descendants of Imam Ali and the Ahlul Bayt and the followers of Ahlul Bayt were being treated. It wasn't that only their possessions and their money was taken away from them. No, the persecution was a great persecution. Yet even in this environment, an Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he was able to endure. He was able to express perseverance and patience and to overcome these challenges. Historians tell us that the Imam himself, he was imprisoned for about 19 years of his life. 19 years of his life, he was imprisoned. He was placed in various prisons, in various dungeons. He was placed under house arrest for 19 years of his life. He faced many other cruelties. He faced assassination attempts in his life, but yet he persevered. He expressed patience and perseverance throughout all of this time. And when we examine various aspects of the life of the Imam, we notice that there are great lessons for us, brothers and sisters, as followers of the Imam. As the Shia of the Ahlul Bayt, there are great lessons in the lives of these individuals, in the lives of these great personalities. When we come to the aspect of the worship of the Imam, historians, they tell us that the Imam alayhi salam, he had devoted his life to worship, to dedication, to devotion to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That the Imam was completely in love with the Qur'an. That the Imam would constantly recite the Qur'an and memorize the Qur'an. And that the Imam, more importantly, lived his life as a walking Qur'an. That people, he would stand and he would recite the Qur'an even in the prisons. Historians, they tell us that in the prisons, the Imam, he would recite the Qur'an, and because his voice was so beautiful and the way that he recited was so sincere and he recited wholeheartedly, that historians tell us the people around him, they would all burst into tears, including the guards, including those housed in various cells. They would burst into tears when they would hear the voice of the Imam reciting the Qur'an. History tells us that the Imam many times in his life that he performed the Hajj on foot, walking from Medina all the way to Mecca on foot. Many times. Because of his dedication. Because of his sincerity in worship and adoration to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When it came to his prayers, he was unmatched in terms of his prayers. Historians tell us that many times the Imam would be seen in a state of prostration, in a state of sujood. That either he was performing the prostration as a sign of what? As a sign of gratitude, as a sign of thanks. One companion, he says, one day I was traveling with the Imam. The Imam, he got off of his mule, and he went into a state of prostration and he remained in a state of sujood for a very long time. And afterwards, after he raised his head, I asked him, Yabna Rasulillah, you know, you went into prostration for a very, very long time. What was happening? The Imam, he replied to him, he said, I remembered one of the favors of Allah, one of the blessings of Allah upon me, and I wanted to thank Allah. And so the Imam would go into sujood, would thank Allah for the blessings that Allah has bestowed upon him. Historians, they tell us that the Imam was known, especially when he was incarcerated, especially when he was in the prisons, that after he would pray the morning prayers, from the time that the sun would rise until noon, the Imam would remain in a state of sujood. would not lift his head from sujood from sunrise until dhuhr, until noon time. To the point where they tell us that there was in one of the prisons that the Imam was housed in, it had a courtyard. And Harun, the Abbasi ruler, sometimes he would like to come and to oversee, to look at the prisoners. He'd like to look at the prisoners. And one day as he was overlooking the courtyard of the prison, he noticed that there was someone, something in the middle. And he asked one of his people, he told him, "What is this garment? What is this piece of cloth that is thrown in the middle of the courtyard? What is this?" The man told him, "This is not a cloth. This is Musa ibn Ja'far. He's prostrating. He's doing sujood. And he does this every day from sunrise until dhuhr time." This was an Imam, Musa ibn Ja'far, and Kalam alayhi salam. When it came to other aspects of worship, one day the Imam was asked by one of his companions, "How many times should we seek forgiveness from Allah every day?" The Imam told him, "I personally seek forgiveness every day. I seek forgiveness 5,000 times. No less. Every day I seek forgiveness from Allah 5,000 times." When we examine the life of the Imam, we notice that he would yearn for solitude. He was noticed time and time again in the prisons when he was placed in the prisons, that he, in his prayers and supplications, he would be thanking Allah. He would say, "Oh Allah, I prayed that you would give me time, solitude, time to spend alone with you, and you have answered my prayers." He saw prison not as an obstacle, but as an opportunity to do what? To devote more time to Allah for prayers. He yearned for this. He wanted to be awake so that he can dedicate his time and his thoughts and his efforts to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to worshiping Allah. He was known. This is one of his characteristics. His love, his affection, his worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is said that one day, the great alim, the founder of the Hanafi school of thought, Abu Hanifa, the very well-known scholar, it is said that one day Abu Hanifa, he approached an Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, and he told the Imam, he told him, I have something to tell you. I want to complain about your son, Musa. And remember, this is during the time where the Imam al-Sadiq was still alive, meaning that the Imam was still young. He was a young man. "I want to complain about your son, Musa. I noticed that when he prays, he does what? He allows people to move in front of him, to pass in front of him." And for Abu Hanifa, this was one of the things that voids prayers. You might have noticed sometimes that those who are praying, if you try to pass in front of them, those who belong to the Hanafi or other schools of thought, if you try to pass in front of them before they pray, they do what? They put out their hand. They stop you. Because they believe that what happens? They may believe that this breaks your prayer. It voids your prayer. So Abu Hanifa was complaining to Imam al-Sadiq. He said, "When I see your son Musa pray, he doesn't stop people from passing in front of him." So the narrator says that Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, he summoned his son Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. He told him, "Come forth." He came and he told him, "Oh Musa, Abu Hanifa here, he's complaining. He's saying that you don't stop people from passing in front of you. Why is it that you do this?" And Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, a young man at the time, he replied such a beautiful reply. He told him, "My dear father, the reason why I do not stop them is because when I pray, my connection with my Lord is so close that nothing comes between me and my Lord." And he recited the verse from the Quran, "وَنَحْنُ أَقْرَبُ إِلَيْهِ مِنْ عَبْدِ الْوَلِيدِ," and we are closer to him than his jugular vein. Allah tells us. This was the love, the understanding, the recognition, the worship of Al-Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. And it's important for us brothers and sisters to ask ourselves. To really ask ourselves. In today's day and age especially. And I know everyone I'm also part of this. We become busy with our school and with our work and with family and with making a living. And we are entangled with our everyday routines and everyday issues that sometimes we lose sight of what is important and our objective in this life. But we have to ask ourselves, what about my worship? How is my relationship with the Quran? Do I open the Quran? Or does maybe days and weeks and months pass by where I don't even open the Quran? I don't even look at the Quran. When it comes to my prayers, how many times have I, in gratitude, in thanking Allah, have I placed my forehead on the ground and thanked Allah for one of the innumerable blessings that I've been given? How many times have I prostrated in sincerity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Do I remember to seek forgiveness on a daily basis? The Imam, who is an infallible, we believe he's an infallible, ma'soom, every day he would ask for forgiveness 5,000 times. And this is not just holding a tasbih like you and me and saying astaghfirullah, astaghfirullah. When the Imam asks for forgiveness, he truly asks for forgiveness. I have to ask myself, do I at least once a day, stop for a moment and seek forgiveness from Allah? Oh my Lord, I have committed a crime, I have committed a mistake, I have done something wrong, I seek forgiveness. And we know that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the most merciful, is the most compassionate. Allah is not one to deny us forgiveness if we are sincere. We have to ask ourselves, how is my relationship with Allah? We are not expected to stay in sujood, in prostration from sunrise until dhuhr. No. We're not expected to do this. Because we don't have that level of dedication and iman. And it's not even expected of us. But we have to ask ourselves, what am I doing? As a follower of the Imam, am I even performing a fraction of what the Imam teaches me when it comes to my worship and dedication towards Allah? This is one aspect. Another aspect of the life of the Imam was that he was known for his kindness and his generosity. That both, he was kind and generous both in public and private. The Imam was known never to say no. Never to say no. Those who were in need, although the Imam was not rich, you know, the Imam was not wealthy, but whoever was in need, the Imam would give him or her as much as he could. Any person who was in need, the Imam would help. He was known for his kindness, he was known for his generosity, and that this generosity was not for fame. Because publicly, sometimes, and I say this about myself, maybe I might help someone publicly, and I'm doing so what? Not necessarily for the sake of Allah, but so that my friend, my neighbor, my co-worker can see me and say, MashaAllah, look at this person, he's giving money, he's giving help, he's dedicating his time, his efforts. We look for what? We look for recognition, we look for praise. This is how most of us are. When the Imams, they would help, they would not look for recognition. They would do so what? إِنَّمَا نُطَعِمُكُمْ لِوَجْهِ اللَّهِ. Allah tells us in the Quran, on behalf of the Ahlul Bayt, on behalf of the Ahlul Bayt, that we feed you, إِنَّمَا نُطْعِمُكُمْ لِوَجْهِ اللَّهِ, only for the sake of Allah. لَا نُرِيدُ مِنْكُمْ جَزَاءً وَلَا شُكُورًا. We don't look for praise or recognition or thanks from you, no. All recognition and praise comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The reward comes from Allah. This was the sincerity that they had. And to prove this sincerity, the Imam was not only known to publicly help people, but even privately. Even privately. Yes, it's important that we encourage others to help publicly, because some people might be encouraged. As long as we have sincerity in our heart, this is also a form of encouragement. We encourage others to help too. But what is also important, that we keep some of this help and some of this assistance, what? Secrets, private, just between me and Allah. And this is what the Imam would do. He was known by the narrators and the companions. He was known to go in the middle of the night, just like his ancestor Amir al-Mu'min, just like his grandfather Amir al-Mu'min, and other Imams. They were known to do what? They were known to go in the middle of the night and to carry bags of supplies and foods and things. and to go around the city and to distribute to those who were in need. And they would do so in the evening, covering their head, so that what? So that people would not recognize them. But who else? But who else? Was there anyone else that would do this act? No, of course. They knew this was Al-Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, because no one else would do this act. Because this was how the Ahlul Bayt, they lived their lives. They were known for their kindness and they were known for their generosity. And this is why Al-Imam al-Kadhim is known as what? Bab al-Hawaj. Such a beautiful title. Such a beautiful title. Bab al-Hawaj. The door towards the answering of prayers. Because Al-Imam al-Kadhim, never in his life did he reject anyone and say no. No. He always put others before himself. He was altruistic. He took care of others before himself. He had learned. After all, his grandmother Fatima al-Zahra alayhi salam had taught his great uncle Al-Imam al-Hasan al-Jar thumma al-Dar. Your neighbor, your friend, your companion before yourself. Put others before yourself. And this is why he is known as Bab al-Hawaj, not only during his life, but even after his death. That people from all around the world, they go to Al-Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, and they seek their hajat. They ask Allah for their hajat for the sake of the Imam, and they are granted their hajat, because he is known as Bab al-Hawaj. However, unfortunately, although the Imam had dedicated his life to worship, to teaching others, there are many other aspects of the life of the Imam we don't have time to talk about tonight. But although he had dedicated his life mostly to this, and he had made no threat towards the Abbasis, no, the Imam lived his life privately. He taught people, he educated people privately. But yet, look at the extremism of these individuals, where they could not handle. History tells us that Harun, he came to Medina in order to perform the Hajj, first to visit the Prophet in Medina. And when he entered the mosque of the Prophet, he noticed that the people had gathered around Al-Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, that he was popular. Of course, and how can you not be popular? When you are kind and when you are generous and when you teach others and when you give your time and efforts to others, of course people will come to you. And so he noticed the popularity and he began to fear that this popularity would result in what? In him losing his throne, his chair, his power. And so historians, they tell us that immediately he ordered his people to capture Al-Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam in the mosque of the Prophet while he was praying. Historians, they tell us that his forces, Harun's forces, they came, they captured the Imam, they tied him, they chained him, and they sent him to Basra. They sent him to Basra. There he was imprisoned for a year under the prison of Isa ibn Ja'far, a man by the name of Isa ibn Ja'far, for a year. And he was asked to report back to Harun. After a year, Isa ibn Ja'far, he wrote a letter to Harun. He told him, listen, I don't want to keep Musa al-Kadhim here anymore. Because in the past year, he has made no threats. I have even sent spies in the prison in the night to hear, to see if he even prays for your destruction, but he has never done so. Even in his private prayers, we have never heard him say anything bad about you. And I have nothing to hold against him. He has done nothing wrong. So I cannot keep him in this prison anymore. And so after a year, the Imam was taken from Basra. He was taken where? To Baghdad. In Baghdad, he was also placed in another prison. The person in charge of the prison, he also did not want to torture him, did not want to bother him. And as a result, he was punished. He was tortured. And then finally, the Imam was taken to what? He was taken to the dungeon of As-Sindi ibn Shahik, who was known to be a cruel person. Who in his blood, he was known to be a cruel person. One of the cruelest and most brutal people. He was taken to the prison, or more the dungeon of As-Sindi. A place where the imam would not see. He would be underground, placed in a dungeon. He was persecuted. And the days went by and they came until Harun could not even stand it anymore. Not only had he imprisoned and persecuted the imam in the dungeons for many years, but he decided that he had to take the life of the imam. And so historians, they tell us that he sent to the imam food that was poisoned, and on the 25th of the month of Rajab in the year 183, al-Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he attained martyrdom. I'd like to end with just a few words of poetry that I wrote last year when I was in Qom, actually, on the eve of the Shahada, the martyrdom of al-Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. I was in the city of a Sayyida Ma'suma, the sister, his sister. And as I was there, I wrote a few words of poetry I'd like to share with you tonight as I end. From dungeon to dungeon and cell to cell. From dungeon to dungeon and cell to cell. Locked up all alone with no way to tell. Whether it was day or night, night or day, but his shining face would lead him the way. Their treatment of Musa was inhumane. Their treatment of Musa was inhumane, tying his body with chain after chain. But animals bowed down to him in awe. Historians, they tell us that sometimes the animals would be sent, a lion would be sent in order to scare the imam. But yet the lion would bow down before the imam, the historians, they tell us. But animals bowed down to him in awe. They knew their master and his light they saw. Like Yusuf, you spent your days underground. Prophet Yusuf, who was imprisoned. Like Yusuf, you spent your days underground. None saw your face nor heard from you a sound. Yusuf then came out and became a king. Yusuf then came out and became a king. You, master, felt the poison and its sting. But Yusuf, with all his glory and might, does not have your dome and its pleasing sight. But Yusuf, with all his glory and might, does not have your dome and its pleasing sight. Yusuf, with all his greatness and deeds, does not cure ailments and satisfy needs. Yusuf, with all his greatness and deeds, does not cure ailments and satisfy needs. Tonight, condolences to all I give, Shia and lovers, wherever they live. Tonight, condolences to all I give, Shia and lovers, wherever they live. Lord, grant us the chance to visit him soon, to open our hearts and with him commune. Lord, grant us the chance to visit him soon, to open our hearts and with him commune. Today for Musa we weep and shed tears. Today for Musa we weep and shed tears. Tomorrow with him we shall lose all fears. Today with Musa we shed tears. We weep and shed tears. Tomorrow with him we shall lose all tears. Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Wa sa'alamu alladhina zalamu ala Muhammadin ayya munqalabin yanqalibun. Wa al-aqibatu lil-muttaqin. Wa ila arwah al-mu'minin wal-mu'minat. And for the soul of the Baq brother who passed away recently, Hajdeen Muhammad Faqiri, and for the soul of all of those who have passed away, نهدي جميعا ثواب سورة الفاتحة مع الصلاة على محمد وآل محمد.